All right. Well, good afternoon, everybody. Hi. It is another edition of the Cross and the Crescent Discussion Group here in the Zoom room and on Blog Talk Radio and the Global Patriot Radio Network. It is, of course, the Real Interfaith Dialogue. This is a show where we try to reach out to our Muslim brothers and sisters and friends and try to have a dialogue about the differences between our two religions. This week, we are again blessed to have our good friend, Rob, the Sentinel, the General. I'm not whatever sure whatever names they give you, and I won't repeat some of them I've seen on Facebook. But Ro, and last week he was talking about the High Christology of Mark, and we're going to revisit that because the depth that he went into last week was just absolutely incredible. And I haven't started recording yet. Now I'm recording. There we go. So everybody's going to have to go to Blog Talk Radio in order to listen to the intro. Too bad. Okay, so what we're going to do today is we're going to have Rob come up on mic, and he is going to, again, speak about the high Christology that we find in the Gospel of Mark. And last week, I'm just going to tell you, one of the most fascinating verses, that I was familiar with it, but it really never occurred to me to use that as an authentic or genuine great polemic against Islam's teaching that Jesus never said he was God or never had the attributes of God. And that's when we go to Mark 2, where he healed the paralytic. But when he says, and I saw that Nassam was in, he's not here yet, Nassam in chat said that was just kind of a figurative thing or a passive allusion to Jesus being God. But when you read verse, I think it's 11, where it says, so that you may understand that the Son of Man has the authority to forgive sins on earth, I say to you, pick up your bed and walk. So not only does he forgive sins, things that only God is able to do, but also he confirms his authority to forgive sins by performing a miracle, something that Muhammad never did to confirm anything that he said. And after I got to thinking about that this past week, that was just absolutely amazing. So I'm going to quit running my mouth, and I'm going to let Rob take over. It is real, and real late where he is. But that's okay. He's enjoying himself at O Dark 30. Rob, come up on mic, sir, and let us know what you want us to know today. Go. Hold on. I think I gotta give you permission to do that. Oh, you can. Well, I've lost all control. Oh my goodness. I'm feeling a weakness coming upon. I think we made you co-host. When you were in your co-host, you have permissions to do that. So super deal.
plants with your other plants. So after I give a quick survey of who the Brodians are, the key takeaway point, and this, and I'll end it with this, and then we can go to Q&A. The key takeaway is that early on in Mark's Gospel, and don't forget, Mark's Gospel is considered the first biography of Jesus as far as the dealing with Gospels. Right at the start, or in fact, right at the end of the Markan sandwich, but still right at the start of the Gospel, you already have Pharisees and this thing known as the Herodians as a group that are kind of like their own, think of them as their own like zealot group, like say that, I'm just going to use this loosely, think of like the 300 Spartans. You know, they had their king Leonidas, you know, they're going to do their own thing, right? So think of the Pharisees and the Herodians as the splinter group that are actually, they mean well, they have right intentions. And they're looking for a Messiah king to run their, to lead them. So in other words, they're looking for their Leonidas. So this is why they actually come to Jesus. This is why they're testing him. This is why they're like, oh, who's this and what is he doing? But then he's doing things and saying things that even they are going, hang on a second, this is blasphemous. this is what's so ironic about it. So in other words, it's like, okay, Jesus is now, is not only a threat to the Roman context, right, from a political context, he's even a threat to us, because he's like a lone wolf in this. He's, and in fact, not just a lone wolf, but kind of like last week when I spoke about the Abiathar issue that will then lead to the 12, he's doing his own group calling. So as I put over here in these paragraphs, the Herodians denotes supporters of Herod who owe their position to him and to his relationship with the imperial family. And this is just like a little bit of a history about how, I'll just read this last paragraph here. The establishment of a Jewish king did not necessitate the overthrow of the Romans who ruled in Judea directly and in Galilee indirectly. As Herod had been appointed king of the Jews by the Senate of Rome, the Herodians and Pharisees might very well cooperate in achieving the goal of establishing another Jewish king of Judea. And a little bit of an example of that is when Agrippa I
see you guys.
Was actually appointed as quote unquote Herod in 41 AD, as you see in Acts 12. So in summary, here's the point. In summary, the Pharisees and Herodians agreed in principle that Jesus had to be silenced and perhaps began discussing the tactical question of how this could be achieved, given his popularity. Jesus did not have the political credentials to be quote-unquote king of the Jews. And in the view of the Pharisees, he was too unorthodox, because not only is he doing what he's doing, but he's also eating with tax collectors and sinners. Willing to violate the law in its traditional interpretation and claiming to have a unique status that transcended that of King David. This is ironic because in their local context, they would have made Jesus their king. So in other words, say if Jesus was sort of not, in other words, here's the point. If Jesus wasn't acting in a very bizarre way, in other words, imitating literally Yahweh on earth, but at the same time doing things that at the surface level seems contrary to, say, how Moses would conduct things and so on, and ultimately David. So if Jesus is just like another human prophet, but with a kind of like a Nehemiah, right? Imagine like, because Nehemiah is like that political sort of struggle that, you know, or Ezra, like bringing back Jerusalem into the fold, and then that whole political thing. Like, because don't forget, they're still under Roman or Gentile occupation in the first century. So if Jesus was like a Maccabean, you know, Judas Maccabeus, or like a Nehemiah, it's like, yeah, they would have approached Jesus. They would have said, hey, can you be part of that group? Can you like join our like rebellion? And then finally we can bring Israel to full fold and so on. So in their local context, they would have made Jesus their king. And so, but here's the point. Because Jesus does things that then caught them off guard, right? And as you can see, he's clearly Yahweh in flesh. This is why then Jesus later to Pilate says, my kingdom does not belong to this world, because if my kingdom belonged to this world, my servants would fight to keep me from being handed over to the Jewish leaders. So there's a little hint. It's like, if I was meant to be a human with my own localized human kingdom here, then these guys that you know about, they would have been fighting for me. But then he clearly says, but for now, my kingdom is not from here. And so notice John, this is in John's gospel, end of John's gospel, and yet Mark, which is the first gospel, way in the 50s AD, so way before John's gospel, there's a huge connection between the two gospels, where you have that political thing going on in that private discussion between Jesus and Pilate, and then hence, because John's gospel is high Christology anyway, obviously he's speaking about Jesus, you know, his kingdom from way up there. And then here, early in Mark's gospel, when Jesus is like, the kingdom is at hand, the kingdom of God is at hand, you know, and he's inaugurating the kingdom. And you're seeing this political tension in Mark's gospel about how they want to engage Jesus, obviously in a very evil way, really. Those two, it beautifully connects in that sense. And so, I guess that's all that needs to be said for now. I'm happy to answer questions, because then I can, like, if it's anything else, like, could be chapter 1 all the way to 5 on other issues, I have the material here to engage those questions if you want. So,
well, I had some questions that pertain outside of chapter 5, but Chris had sorry about that. Yeah, I had some questions that are outside of chapter 5, but I think Chris had some. Chris wants to come up on mic. Okay, you got you're kind of soft. I don't know if your mic is turned down or... Well, we can hear you. It's just, that's okay. Keep going. It's, you're clear as a bell, but I was just saying that we weren't very loud. That's all right. Go ahead. When do you put it, Robert? I was just kind of curious. When do you... Okay, I don't know if Chris had anything to add to this or had anything to follow up with, but we do have Dominic Shields here. He has his hand up. Where'd you go, Dominic? You went down here. How'd you get from up there to down there? Let me unmute you. All right, Dominic, did you have a question or a statement or something that you wanted to add to this? Well, can I add something here? I was just gonna offer that the Magdala Temple on the Sea of Galilee. My understanding is that they had just excavated that within the last 20 years, and all of the indications state, and I might have read what you just said, Dominic, wrong, was that they were completely consistent with what first century Jews would worship. They have that Magdala stone there that provides all of their practices, and you go there, they have mitzvahs, or not mitzvah, what's the ritual bath thing called? All of that is there. So is that what you're saying? They were still practicing that, or had gotten away from that? Is that what you said? Maybe I missed what you said. My understanding is there's one up in Capernaum, Magdala, and I think on the west or the east side of, I might be wrong. I know that there's those two. Do you know where the third one might be? Right. But these were all first century. The one in Capernaum and the one that was in Magdala were first century. These prior to exilic period. Well, that's I was just pointing out that the Magdala one was for such a, I did have something I wanted, a direction I wanted to go with this, Rob, if you don't mind. And Dominic, I appreciate the depth that you're coming here, but I think, dude, you're like three floors too deep here for people. I wanted to go to chapter 5 of Mark, if you don't mind. And here would go ahead. Mm-hmm. You can post them in chat. You can cut and paste the link and post it in chat. I don't think you can attach a file. Do you have this on your computer, or is this? I wanted to, the whole focus of this show is to establish some type of link or some type of refutation to Islamic arguments that they have on Christianity. And one of the key things is saying that Jesus is not God. And then when you start bringing up the high Christology of Mark, which they say has a very low Christology, if you listen to Shabir Ali, it evolved over time, da 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 da. But when we look at Mark, we're looking at attributes that only God himself can possess early on. And we talked about this early in the show, and I think you've been covering. But one of the ones that I kind of find interesting is the woman with the issue of blood, and how just touching the robe of Christ, he feels power going out of him, which indicates, go ahead and take it away, Rob. Okay, Adam, I'm going to mute you if you try that again. No, go ahead. You can go into PG. I put whenever I upload these to YouTube, I always put that it's not viewable for children. I do that for a reason, because I want to give us the latitude sometimes that we. Yeah. Well, I'm thinking that perhaps it's a good idea that we don't tell the presidential candidate Joe Biden about this free health care that Jesus would provide to them if it's free and accessible, because he'd probably try to put it in some type of law and sell it to the masses. The historicity of all this and the understanding of the Greco-Roman world and its application here. I was not aware of any of that, and that is just absolutely fabulous. And we appreciate you telling us. The only thing that I was kind of focused on is, okay, Jesus is, if he is God incarnate, and somebody touches him, and the power is taken out of him, whereas all the previous prophets, the previous prophets had to derive whatever powers that they used to perform a miracle had to come from God, whereas this miracle comes straight from him, and that power he gives freely to all believers. Ergo, the free and accessible Obamacare, or we should just call it Jesus Care, is what we should call it. So. Putting Obama on there. I did want you to talk about something else, if you don't mind, Robert. I wanted you to go to chapter 8 of Mark, and I know this is out further than chapter 5, and I wanted you to touch on, if you could, the denial of Christ, or no, not the denial of Christ, the acknowledgement of Christ as the Messiah, the Son of God, by Peter, but then Jesus turns around just two verses later and rebukes Peter for saying that he will not allow Christ to go do something that is denied in the Quran, which is die on a cross. And he tells him, get behind me, Satan, because your eyes are not fixed upon these things of God, but of this world. So if he's telling Peter this, that he has to die, how is, you know, if you could just kind of relate that to an apologetic or a polemic against Islamic theology based on that? Oh my goodness. Disciples have a billion people say I am. Yeah. But down further when he rebukes Peter, down in that right there.
Adam, and I think Dominic as well, access to the Google Drive while you're talking. So, okay. First things first. What region are they located? Now, I just for the sake of time, I won't go back into my study notes, because I bring out way back in chapter 1 this thing where Jesus is like, look, be sure that you don't tell anyone. Like, this is at the end of chapter 1. You know, he certainly warned him, encouraged him to go at once, saying, don't tell anyone. And then he does the same thing even to the demons, he healed many who were sick with various diseases, drove out many demons. However, he wouldn't allow the demons to speak because they knew who he was. Okay, so in other words, the scholars call this the Messianic secret. There's something going on as far as they sort of like suddenly realize who he is, but Jesus at the same time wants to remain anonymous, even to the demons and so on, right? The crux then comes down to in 1 Corinthians 2, where Paul he basically had an epiphany about this. He's like, look, we speak about God's wisdom in a hidden secret. There's that secret language, which God destined before the world began for our glory. And here's why. Because none of the rulers of this world, and rulers of the world in the Greek is the spiritual entities, Satan, you know, power of the earth, all that stuff. None of the rulers of this world understood it. Because if they had, so understood what? Understood the mission of Jesus, right? Because if they had, they would not have crucified Jesus, the Lord of glory. So this is why, like, all throughout the New Testament, like in 1 Peter 1, you have this, you know, even the prophets prophesied about the grace of us. He was carefully researched, investigated salvation. They tried to find what hero specific time, but notice this language, the spirit of the Messiah. So there's a little bit of a hint, you know, the Holy Spirit, Jesus, like in the Old Testament. In them kept referring to when he predicted the sufferings of the Messiah. And notice how he just throws it in there. He's like, look, these are things that even the angels desire to look into. all the way back in Job, in Job 15, you had God saying, what is mankind that he can be blameless, so does being born of a womb mean he'll be in the right? Look, if God doesn't trust his holy ones, so God doesn't trust even the good angels, because the heavens aren't pure as he looks at them, then how much more is man who drinks in justice? So you see this theme even in Isaiah 34 and all these places where God is not going to trust anyone moving forward, and especially coming back to this thing as in the beginning, this is the beginning of the gospel, and the way it all displays it, because God is going to be very careful in how this plays out. He's going to be deliberate, intelligent, strategic in the locations he goes at. I think that I'm going to get into Mark 8 now, but just to give everyone an analogy, if you've seen Daniel Craig's James Bond, the Casino Royale that came out in 2006, that's probably one of my favorite Bond movies, but if any of you have seen it, you'll immediately get where I'm going with this, where Daniel, the James Bond character early in the movie, he's a little bit arrogant. He's sort of like loose with how he goes about his mission. And then he loses the game, like halfway in the movie. And then he realizes, you know what? Okay, I'm enough of mucking around. I'm going to be serious. Because Vespa, I don't want to spoil the movie if you haven't seen it, but I'll just say it anyway. Spoilers. Vespa, his love interest, he falls in love with her a lot. But she betrays him. So, but he doesn't know she's betraying him. But even before he knows, even though she's his love interest, he's not trusting anyone. When he plays that game, the card game, he's just going to play it, pretending even his allies are his enemies. God has that same attitude. When the Tower of Babel took place, moving forward with Abraham, boom, when the disinheritance happens to the nations, I'm not going to trust anyone. It's just me, and that's it. Now, why do you think when Jesus says, the Father and I know what the Father does, and the Father knows what I do? If God doesn't trust anyone, if he's allowing the Son to work in that trust, what does that imply? Jesus can't be a mere creature. He has to be part of the Godhead as part of the planning. Because, like, just to throw it in here, in Acts 1, when you see Jesus saying, well, when the disciples asking, you know, Lord, is this the time when you restore the kingdom of Israel? And he's like, look, it's not for you to know what time spirit the Father has fixed according to his own authority. So he's just like, don't worry about it. Just do what I told you to do. I'll do my bit, you know, the paraclete, the comforter that'll come, that's the Holy Spirit, all that will happen. Okay. Now this is going back to Mark 8. Remember when I spoke about the unclean spirits, that connection to Genesis 6, the Rephaim, all that stuff, right? In Second Temple literature, what was considered as the ground zero for the emergence of the proliferation of demons and evil is actually this location, Caesarea Philippi. So Jesus and his disciples set up at the villages around Caesarea. This is Mount Hermon, where the transfiguration takes place. That's the location he says this is the gates of hell. And in the Matthew account, in Matthew 16, a lot of translations will say...
Hey, can I add something there to that, Robert?
Yep, go for it.
Yeah, when you talk about Caesarea Philippi, this is where they had those Roman temples where they were sacrificing children to the gods.
Mm-hmm.
And this is right at the base of Mount Hermon. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, in the Pan, this Panius and Pan, all those Greek Roman gods. Now, a lot of translations will say the powers of hell or the gates of hell will not conquer this church, because upon this rock I'll build my congregation, the church, and so on. The rock is not Peter or Jesus. The rock is this geographical location Jesus is using as the gates of hell. Upon this rock, this declaration you just made, Peter, you are the Messiah, the Son of God, So it's upon this rock I'm going to build my congregation, ecclesia, the kingdom of God, right, is now being inaugurated. The nations are going to crumble. Where it started, which is this location, the gates of hell, now translation is to say conquer. In the Greek, it's literally withstand. So the gates of hell will not withstand it. So who's doing the attacking? Do gates attack the church? No, gates are defensive structures. So upon this rock, I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not withstand the onslaught of the church. And hence why Paul says in like Romans, I think it's at the end in Romans 16, where he's like Satan is being crushed under the feet of the church. Yeah, over here it is. The God of peace will soon crush Satan under your feet. But why? Because again, like in Ephesians, we are seated with Christ in the heavenlies. And even though he's far above every rule, authority, power, dominion, and every name that can be named, God has put everything under the Messiah's feet and has made him the head of everything for the good of the church, which is his body. And so this, so if we are in Jesus, then everything is underneath Jesus, right? But we are with Jesus. So in other words, we're not under Jesus' feet. We're with Jesus in that council realm, in the resurrection and so on. And hence, the dark forces are under the feet of Jesus. And hence, we, the church, so Satan is under our feet in turn. So coming back to Mark 8, now that we see this dark context of Caesarea Philippi, then he asks the question, who do people say I am? Now notice, this is again an insight as to what we were just discussing a moment ago, this very rich heritage of where the Jews at the time were like, this person, that person, but specifically now already since John the Baptist is established, so some say John the Baptist, so this is Elijah, so others are one of the prophets. But who do you say I am? Peter says, you are the Messiah. And I noticed this again, Messianic secret happening just again. Certainly ordered them not to tell anyone, right? Then when he says this next bit, this is an insight as to where Jesus is cunning in the sense of that secret. Even though Peter got it right, yeah, you are the Messiah, right? He still doesn't know why. But that is not a wrong thing. That's actually a good thing. Because see, he's testing them. He's like, look, then he began to teach them that the Son of Man, that divine Son of Man of Daniel 7, would have to suffer a great deal and be rejected by the elders, high priests, and scribes. Remember that Herodian context I mentioned a moment ago? Then he would be killed, and after 3 days he'd rise again. He was speaking about this matter quite. Now notice this, I just love how Mark, because this is the point, and scholars will point this out. Mark has been building up this messianic secret, you know, all through the chapters, and then Mark, this shows the historicity of this discussion, because suddenly he's being a bit frank about it. He's being quite open, which is, I mean, Jesus, weren't you saying, just a moment ago, you said, you know, certainly ordered them not to tell anyone, and then suddenly Jesus goes into this, well, let me tell you about the future. Remember Doc Brown and Back to the Future, he's like, Marty, you could cause serious displacement in the time, space-time fabric if you tell people about the future. So Peter then took him aside and was like, look, began to rebuke him. This is ridiculous, because as far as I know in Daniel 7, the Son of Man doesn't die. The Son of Man receives a kingdom, right? But turning and looking at his disciples, Jesus rebuked Peter, saying, get behind me. And now Satan here is not the devil. You could sort of connect this to the Caesarea Philippi sort of region, the demonic sort of context of this region. Satan, as it were, just means opposer. In fact, for example, in the Old Testament, you have Yahweh called Satan. For example, when the angel of the Lord opposes Balaam's donkey, he's ha-sataning Balaam's donkey. Or when Yahweh is opposing, say, David in Chronicles, like in 1 Chronicles 21, like you see Satan, you know, like the Samuel account will say Yahweh, the Chronicles will say Satan. Yep, yes, it's one and the same person. In other words, Satan just means to oppose, to like to push against. So get behind me, you opposer, because you're not thinking God's thoughts, but human thoughts. And that's, again, an insight. God's thoughts, so my ways, not your ways. And this is connecting to they still don't know the plan, which is good. So then Jesus called the crowd to himself along with the disciples. If anyone wants to follow me, he must deny himself, you know, all that stuff. Like, notice he goes back to Son of Man language. Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes. Now notice this, with the holy angels in his Father's glory. Later on in Mark 13, Jesus says the Son of Man will send out his angels to gather the elect. The Son of Man's coming in clouds, the cloud rider. So, now this has been connected to not just the transfiguration, but also the resurrection. I tell all of you, certainly some people standing here will not experience death until they see the kingdom of God arrive with power. Boom, that's resurrection, right? Then, like 6 days later, that high mountain in that same region, Mount Hermon, and then transfiguration takes place. So, this is my response to, you know, those people who are confused about this passage. Again, huge high Christology right through it.
Okay, well, I didn't understand that last thing you said. That's probably why there's some awkward pause there. Sorry about that. But this is where.
Did I need to clarify anything, by the way?
Perfectly clear. But when we start talking about the denial of the crucifixion itself, this is the centrality of the Christian faith, and to try to say that you are a prophet in the line of Jesus and you deny the one central thing of the faith itself, the Christianity itself, I don't see how you could be, demonstrate any clearer that you're a false prophet. That's just my opinion. But when you deny what the central event in Christianity never happened, that just demonstrates to me that you have no idea what the Christian faith is all about. And we also find that littered, in 4:157, 5:116, where he tries to associate, 4:171, I'm sorry, where he tries to associate.
Oh, yeah, in the Quranic context.
Trying to make Mary part of the Trinity.
Well, okay, that's right, I forgot. I was trying to remember because you wanted to connect it to the Quran.
Yeah.
There is a paper I have by a Muslim that he can't help, he debated Shabir Ali. And in fact, Tony Costa, this particular, I think his name was Khalid something, and then Shabir Ali, the three of them were in this panel. And Shabir just couldn't help. He just didn't know how to respond to what Khalid was saying. I think his name is Khalid. I could be mispronouncing his name. But he goes, when the Quran says, and I'm kind of paraphrasing it, but it appeared to them that he was crucified, but he was not, for Allah took him. So he's like, well, that actually doesn't contradict the Christian scriptures, because we know for a fact in history, it's a bedrock fact, Jesus was crucified. In fact, and this is his point in that discussion, which is a brilliant insight, and it's such a simple insight. If you remove all bias and you just read chronologically through Mark, from Mark 1, 2, 3, you start to see this build-up, God and flesh, and a man at the same time, but God and flesh. If Mark 16 did not happen, the resurrection, it would be a massive backfire. You've just built up this entire case for this person, Jesus. And then it just, what, he doesn't resurrect?
Right.
So then he goes, when the Quran says it appeared that he died, but he was not, for Allah took him, What if that's a hint to, because Christians believe this, that we don't believe, so I'll ask you, Eric, do you believe that the Logos died, that the divine nature died? And you'd say no. It's the human body that died. That's it. So it appeared that he died, but he did not, for Allah took him, and that's exactly what Jesus says, Father, into your hands, I give him a spirit. And so the divine nature of Jesus, that divine nature, the spiritual nature, that was not crucified or killed. It was the human body that died, and hence the Quranic perception of it appeared that he died. It's not denying that he died. It appeared that he died, but he did actually not die, for Allah took him. So in that sense, that reading is actually defending the crucifixion of Jesus and the ascension of Jesus' spirit, well, in this case, the Logos entity. And so I have the paper on that if anyone's interested. It's in my Google. In fact, I'll bring it up just for everyone to see.
Well, we had we did an entire show one afternoon on a professor from the Tuna University out in California, an Islamic university. And this guy's whole thesis was that 4:157 does not teach that Jesus was saved from the cross. It does not teach that Jesus did not die on the cross. And that was his whole supposition. And he gives a very intelligent, and very compelling, I might add, presentation, saying that Islam does not teach that. His problem is, this is just me thinking, is that 5.99999 billion other Muslims thinking that he's wrong, or the majority of them think he's wrong. So when Jesus starts, and I'll circle back the wagons here. So when Jesus starts rebuking Peter for saying, "No, I'm going to prevent you from going to Jerusalem to be crucified," what he's doing is essentially doing the same thing that Muhammad did. And Jesus tells him, "Hey, get behind me, Satan. My thoughts are on, heavenly things. Yours are on earthly things." And this is the same thing that Muhammad did. How can Jesus be crucified? I mean, he is, the servant of God. He's the prophet of God. So he could not mix those two things. Who's this by?
Okay, I just found it. So it's Khalil and Dani. So this is the paper here. And by the way, he's a legit scholar. He's written, I think he's doing a Harvard dissertation. They killed him not, the crucifixion in Shiite Ismaili Islam. So they killed him not, nor crucified him, but so it was made to appear to them. And then another verse, think not of those who are slain in God's way as dead. May they live, finding their sustenance in the presence of the Lord. So I won't go through all this, but I'll just show you a bullet point summary he makes.
If I may state a little over here. The Shia sect is already a very smaller sect of Islam, and Shia Ismailis are once again subsect of Shia Islam. So this guy is in minority of the minority. So that's the problem.
To be honest, Patricia Crone, for example, in her work, she says that if you take the first 500 years of church history, first century to fifth and sixth century, mash all Jewish literature, Christian literature, Gnostic literature, patristic writings, just mash it in a big blender, right? Blend it up. Then do a big, like extraction, like reaction, right? Like drenching out all the unnecessary liquids, right? You get the Quran. And so I agree with that. It's like, it's this mashed up mishmash of Gnostic, Christian, Jew, patristic, It just shows that. And I can't help but go, well, why is this person, even though he's a minority, he's still able to read that verse and be pro-Christian about it? So look at this deductive argument he makes. He's like, look, his mainly position on the crucifixion. Now imagine you and I, we're not Christian. We just shown this bullet point list. And then one day we go to church, and a Christian is preaching about the crucifixion. the challenge is there a difference? And in my opinion, I don't see a difference. So he says, historically, Jesus was crucified and killed. There was no substitute. Boom. Yep, all scholars agree with that. Even secular scholars agree with that, that this historical Jesus research. That which, quote-unquote, appeared to them, and I think Adam would know that the Arabic here.
Subhanallah, yes.
Is that the Arabic?
Yeah, Subhan bil... What is that? Anyhow.
Okay. Well, that which appeared to them as being crucified was precisely the body of human nature of Jesus. I don't know if he's trying to translate in a very clean way the Arabic into English, but...
Shubhalahum. Yeah, so that's the Arabic of the Quran 4:157. Shubhalahum means it appeared to them as if. So shubha means a doubtful. So basically, if I need to say I'm a doubt in Arabic, I will say I have a shubha. So shubhalahum is it appeared to them as they doubted that it was Jesus. So because he's actually referring to Quran verses 4:157, which actually clearly says that it starts from saying that, and Jews says basically, indeed we have killed the Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, the messenger of Allah, and they killed him not. So we say, وَمَا قَتَلُوا وَمَا سُلُبُوا. They killed him not they were crucifying, وَلَكِنْ شُبْحَ لَهُمْ. But it appeared to them as if.
Yeah. So that which appeared to them as being crucified was precisely the body of human nature, I think it's the nasut of Jesus. So being crucified was precise. What was being crucified was the human nature, right? Christ's soul, as manifestation of his divine nature, the lahut, could not be killed. And this is what the Quran speaks of when it says they killed him not, nor did they crucify him, the soul part. The Bible and the Quran are thus in agreement over the crucifixion.
The problem with that, the problem with that is the post crucifixion sightings, the resurrection sightings. That's the whole problem with this supposition here. It's a denial of the true gospel, which was taught by Christians and has been taught by Christians for 2,000 years. And he gets up in there and he denies it. And I think then this is why I wanted you to tie that verse there in chapter 8 where Jesus is telling Peter, this is a thing of, this is essentially a thing of Satan, is to deny my death, try to prevent it and make it just appear that I died. Well, what's the purpose of that? I mean, it has nothing to do with Old Testament atonement or anything of that nature. Okay, as you can hear, that's our 90-second warning.
I just want to point it out that Peter, in his context, is not thinking the way Muslims are thinking. He's thinking of Daniel 7, the Son of Man, who does not die. This is new stuff because it's connected to the secret motif that God hasn't planned. Because Paul says, if Satan knew the plan, he would not have killed Jesus. That, meaning the fact that Peter's reacting is God still working. Even Peter is there. It's like, when Jesus says you're close to the kingdom, but not really. Peter is on the right track, but he still doesn't know what do you mean Jesus, Son of Man, is going to die? Okay, just wait and watch. And sure enough, that happens. And then finally they get it. Son of Man has to die in then order to receive the kingdom and then the saints as part of that whole thing.
My whole opinion is that it didn't appear to anybody. I mean, this is as good as historical fact as you possibly can get if you do history. And that's kind of my cognate area on my undergrad studies. So, all right, guys, we're going to go ahead and... Stephanie, please let Stephanie. Stephanie, she's got her hand up. Oh, my goodness. Okay. It looks like we're going to... Okay, Stephanie, I'm going to bring you up on... I just unmuted you, Missy. Stephanie is a Muslim, Rob, if you didn't realize that. She's a very popular girl on Facebook, I might add. And she's got a bit of an accent, but we can't understand her. So go ahead, Steph.
Oh, Vlad's in the room. Hey, Vlad. It's my good friend, Vlad.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to comment about what
Okay, what we're going to do, Seth, here's what we're going to do. Hey, Vlad, let's see if you made it midday. Even though you're like an hour and 59 minutes late, it's okay. What we're going to do is we're going to make this the topic of next week. We're going to make the crucifixion the topic of next week. And, Steph, if you want to prepare some stuff, and I'll let you come up on mic next week. And okay, go ahead, bro. Go ahead, but we're going to make this topic. I can give you 5 minutes, but we can't go much longer than that because the recording gets too long and I can't upload it to Blog Talk Radio. So go ahead. Okay, and this is something, and this is, go ahead, Robin. Okay. What we're going to be doing is we're going to be picking this discussion up next week, Steph. I appreciate. Okay. All right. No. I got to cut this out, Stephanie, because I'm going to go way too long, and I'm not going to be able to upload this. All right, Missy, be back here next Sunday. As a matter of fact, I'm going to IM you when we get off of here on Facebook, and we'll get this straightened out for next week. Again, Rob, thank you so much for coming and spending your the middle of your night with us and enjoying a good bottle of scotch. Yeah, I see that. I was wondering if you got that thing down. Everybody else that's come, again, I thank you so much for coming. Don't forget this Tuesday, Radio Free Kaffir Stand, we're going to have Chris Claus coming up, and we're going to be talking about Deuteronomy 18:18, the article that I got to be the editor for that article. All the content's Chris's, but I got to edit that, and we put it up on thecrossandthecrescent.com, so I hope that you go up there and read that, and we'll be discussing that. And Adam, you need to show up Tuesday also, because I wanted to discuss that article that you have on your website that lists the Islamic countries and their laws as far as apostasy is concerned. Again, God bless everybody, and we will see you next Sunday on the Cross and Crescent Discussion Group. Again, thank you everybody for coming. Yes. Yeah, I'll send it to you. You got it. We got it all there. All right. We'll see y'all next Sunday.